Are you ready for the quantum age?
Humanity's next step in evolution?
Dream Vision 7 Radio Network invites you to the extraordinary platform of evolutionary voices for the quantum age.
Let's explore. Learn more about this upcoming age where we bridge science with spirituality.
Where potentiality meets reality.
Where we take compassion into action.
Our trailblazers and visionaries will ask the whys, the what ifs, while igniting continuous possibility.
Come along with us into an age beyond what we know today, where we can grow together in unity consciousness.
Experience evolutionary voices for the quantum age, Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern on DreamVision7Radio.com.
Welcome, everyone, to Islands of Sanity. I'm your host, Carolyn Baker. As you know, we've been focusing on coping with collapse in our series by that name since the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. We've highlighted the emotions of fear, anxiety, anger, and grief, and we'll continue with our series going forward. My guest today is not a diversion from the focus of the series, but is someone who brings tremendous perspective to the collapse conversation and offers yet another perspective for making sense of it. He is Eric Garza, a podcaster, writer, and educator. His most recent podcast project, Embracing Apocalypse, explored the interplay between catastrophe and revelation in the modern world. He studied ecological economics at the University of Vermont, where he's taught for nearly a decade. Outside of the university setting, he teaches and mentors people on gathering and preparing wild, edible, and medicinal plants, subsistence hunting and fishing, and minimalism. So, Eric, welcome to Islands of Sanity. I really appreciate your work, and I thank you again for having me as a guest recently on your Embracing Apocalypse series.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Carolyn. It's a privilege to be here.
Well, you know, in your work, you talk about the two meanings of apocalypse, as I said, catastrophe and revelation, and how they're intimately intertwined. I would love to hear more about this, and I'm sure our listeners would as well.
Yeah, so maybe I'll elaborate a little bit on the meanings of it first. I mean, it's common for people to when we talk about apocalypse in the modern day, oftentimes we're talking about events that are catastrophic or cataclysmic or where there's a lot of destruction. We see this in movies. We see this in books. But when you follow the etymology of the word apocalypse back through history, you end up in ancient Greece. And the English version of apocalypse started as apocalypton, and I might not be pronouncing that exactly correctly, but you can discern the original meaning of this word from its Greek roots. Apo meant un, and then kalupton meant to cover or to reveal. So apocalypton originally meant to uncover, to reveal, to disclose, and it migrated from there, from ancient Greek, into Latin as apocalypsis, and then was incorporated into Abrahamic scripture, probably around 2,000 years ago. And at that time, it retained its older meaning, which was a close synonym for the word revelation. So apocalypse and revelation were oftentimes used interchangeably. And revelation, of course, being, the revealing of truth in sometimes a surprising or dramatic way. And the meaning of words often changes over time. That doesn't really surprise anyone who studied the English language. But I think it's worthwhile to reach back and lift up this older meaning of apocalypse because it is, I think, deeply prescient. Like you mentioned, the meaning of, or the realities of catastrophe and revelation are deeply intertwined in our modern world. When the systems that support us, environmental systems and social systems, are working, they're meeting our needs, oftentimes people don't think too critically about them. You know, they just continue cutting the trees, you know, digging for coal, extracting oil, that kind of thing. It's only when there's evidence that those systems are not supporting us that we feel inspired to investigate their deeper workings. And then, lo and behold, truths are revealed. And so, like, we think of the global climate crisis that we're embedded in now, which is, you know, spanning even broader territory than this coronavirus pandemic. A lot of our modern understanding of the climate systems on Earth emerged from worries that people had about anthropogenic climate change. So we saw that that system was starting to fail. We investigated, and now we have a much better understanding of that system, or at least some of us have a much better understanding of that system than we had before. So that's what I mean when I say that those two things are intertwined. You know, the catastrophe happens, or it comes knocking at our door, and then that catches our attention. We investigate, and you know, new truths are revealed that we find we have to contend with.
Well, what's interesting as you say that is how many things are being revealed in this pandemic. You know, the horrible economic inequality in our culture and in the world, the racism, you know, as so many people of color and poor people and elderly are experiencing the pandemic and dying from it, you know, just endless revelations in this one crisis. So it makes perfect sense. I was thinking about, you know, the book of Revelation in the Bible, quote unquote, being, you know, a giant apocalypse, you know, an uncovering of deeper realities, and very symbolic, but nevertheless pointing to deeper realities in our predicament.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And yeah, I mean, all the issues you brought up, and also a lot of the fragilities inherent in our economic system are showing up as supply chains are breaking down because certain people have been sent home and can't do their work. You know, I teach a lot, or I should say I taught a lot. My job as an instructor at a university is probably coming to its end, you know, owing to this pandemic, but I taught a lot in the food space, you know, food systems courses, as we call them at the University of Vermont. And in the food sector, we see a lot of breakdown throughout food supply chains. And this is hitting some places harder than it is others around the world, as well as within the United States. I am not seeing it so much when I go to the grocery store here yet, but certainly within a month or two, I expect to. But yeah, we depend overwhelmingly on kind of this just-in-time inventory system, and that works great when all those supply chains work well. Now that there are disruptions, it's going to start working a lot less great, and it's probably going to inspire, or at least I should say hopefully inspire, people to think about alternative ways of meeting their needs and alternative ways of designing economies so that we're not so overwhelmingly dependent on, you know, faraway things we can't control in order to meet our immediate needs.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about the trauma in all of this pandemic situation that we're dealing with right now, and just the trauma in collapse in general. We're learning a lot more about trauma these days than humans have ever known. In the sense that scientific data about trauma is now available to us that wasn't available until very recently. Trauma inherently distances us from others, from the earth, and from ourselves. Now, you talk about the link between people's disconnection and not only their current trauma, but the trauma of their ancestors. I'd love it if you'd say more about this very, very important reality.
I would love to, and this is an area of very, very deep research for me. You know, just the research that I've done so far makes it pretty clear to me that trauma And I should talk about what I mean by trauma, because people use that word in a lot of different ways right now.
Right.
But when I use the word trauma, what I'm referring to are changes in behavior patterns in people that are the result of them having overwhelmed nervous systems in the past and never being able to metabolize that nervous system overwhelm. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you were abused as a child, you had this chronically overwhelmed nervous system as a result of that. And if you were never able to kind of debrief that whole situation and metabolize that nervous system overwhelm and all the hormones and whatnot that went along with it, that changes your nervous system. It rewires your nervous system and sometimes even changes your epigenetic code. You know, it changes you epigenetically. And so you literally become a different person. And this new person that results from this chronic overwhelmed nervous system, you're going to have different constraints on your behavior than you would if you had never experienced that, or if you had experienced it, but at least you had someone there to help you debrief that and metabolize that and kind of shed all that nervous system overwhelm. So when I say trauma, that's what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And I use the example of something that might have happened in our childhood, but there's some amazing research out there that suggests that physiological changes that are caused by this overwhelm are actually heritable across generations. So like if your parents or grandparents suffered some kind of nervous system overwhelm, like for example, people were culturally Jewish, you know, and whose relatives might have survived the Holocaust or who might have been close to someone who survived the Holocaust, you know, that's obviously a terrifyingly traumatic event. It changed those people epigenetically, and those epigenetic changes became heritable. And there's people who've done research and been able to trace this. And, you know, there's solid research that suggests that, you know, you can inherit traumas that people experienced two or three generations back. And I suspect that you can inherit traumas that reach much further back in time than just a couple of generations. I suspect that as we do more research, we'll learn that, you know, many, many generations worth of trauma can be inherited. And you know, with that, as a kind of an understanding, realize that the kind of people we are, unless we dive in and really do the work of understanding this trauma that we have inherited and how we might metabolize it and kind of heal from all of those, you know, overwhelmed nervous systems in the past, it really constrains who we can be as people. And, you know, one of the ideas that I talk about sometimes is this idea of degrees of freedom. The more degrees of freedom you have, the more opportunities you have to respond to events that you're faced with in novel ways, in different ways, in more useful ways. And people who inherit a lot of this trauma have very few degrees of freedom. You know, they're very rooted to old habits, and they have a hard time responding well to novel situations. So, you know, I guess one of the ways that I've started thinking about this is that from an activist perspective, and even, you know, if you'll let me use this word, just from a purely survivalist perspective, mm-hmm. I feel like our number one priority right now needs to be doing this inner healing so that we can respond to all these scenarios that we're faced with, whether it's pandemics or climate change or economic collapse or anything. You know, we need to be able to respond to those in, you know, the most useful and productive and compassionate and inclusive ways that we possibly can. And the more of our trauma, whether it's personal trauma or historical or ancestral trauma, that we can heal, the easier that it will be for us to do that.
Well, you know, you're speaking science here, but indigenous cultures have pretty much known this forever, you know, shamanic cultures where, you know, the shaman examines what is troubling a person and often points to and is able to see way back in time the trauma that they experienced. And now science is beginning to reveal that that's not outrageous. In fact, that's pretty much right on. And we've discovered this new, or scientists have come together to study the epigenetic theories that point to the trauma of our ancestors actually influencing the inheritance of traits. So science is beginning to discover things that ancient peoples have known for thousands of years.
Yeah. And, you know, just to, you know, bring a very specific example of that to the fore, I live in Vermont, and, you know, prior to European colonization, this would have been Wabanaki territory. So Western Abenaki people would have lived here, but other people in the Wabanaki Confederacy would have lived in other parts of the Northeast, New England. And they have a story that I learned originally from Sherry Mitchell in her book, Sacred Instructions, and she told this story on an episode of my podcast. But they have a story, and I'm not going to try to pronounce the Wabanaki name for this character, but they have a story that revolves around this cannibal giant. And so their story is that there's a cannibal giant that sleeps in the forest. And when people start consuming resources or harming the landscape faster than Mother Nature can heal, Mother Nature will issue a certain call that will wake up this cannibal giant. And the cannibal giant will start dancing. And as the cannibal giant dances, it inspires people to start consuming faster. And the cannibal giant dances faster and faster, and so people consume faster and faster until they literally consume themselves off the planet. You know, this is like civilizational collapse brought about by this cannibal giant. And then once society collapses, the cannibal giant goes back to sleep and Mother Earth can heal. And that's a fascinating story because when you look at how that corresponds to the way our nervous systems work, there's just about a perfect link. Like right now, we see that so much of the consumerism in the world today is really basically self-medication. Mm-hmm. It's novel experiences and products that people use to get little bursts of dopamine and other neurotransmitters and hormones to hide their pain. And the faster that that environmental systems break down and the more anxiety that people have, the more they need to hide this pain, so the more they're going to consume.
Right.
And we'll basically, unless we wake up and understand what's going on and deliberately, you know, work on our issues, we're going to consume ourselves off the planet. And environmentalists have been saying that for years and years and years. But it's clear that that pattern, that overarching pattern of overconsumption leading to collapse, you know, it's not new. It's not new on this planet, what's going on in our times, and it certainly wasn't new to indigenous peoples in, you know, what we today call North America. You know, when I was chatting with Sherry Mitchell on my podcast, she just mentioned in this offhand way that, you know, they knew this story because this has happened to them many times. You know, she says that according to the stories, Wabanaki stories that she learned, you know, their civilization had emerged, collapsed, and then died out, and then been reseeded four times before the present.
Mm.
So they had seen this over and over and over again.
Well, the opposite of overconsumption, of course, is minimalism, which you talk about in other contexts. And I'd like you to define it and explain why the practice of minimalism is so important to you.
Yeah. Here again, people use minimalism in different ways in different contexts. When I talk about minimalism, on a purely consumptive standpoint, it basically means using, you know, certainly meeting your needs. This is not about starving myself or causing myself to suffer because I have so little stuff. But it is about learning and exploring what is necessary and then turning into a practice, embracing that and kind of living at or below that edge. And for me, I think of minimalism really as a not necessarily a set of goals in itself, as much as it is an outgrowth from a spiritual and a healing practice. What I have discovered as I've, you know, spent years at this point, decades really, working on my own trauma, healing my own trauma, the more trauma that I heal, the less I need. You know, the less pain and agony that I need to cover up with all these novel experiences. And so the less stuff that I need to surround myself by, the less I feel inspired to use physical possessions as, you know, shows of status, the less fancier things that I feel like I need to purchase them, and the less urge I have to purchase novel things in the first place. Mm-hmm. So I definitely, you know, there are a lot of people who think of minimalism as this thing where you try to get rid of all your stuff and you buy less and you only buy in thrift stores. And I would never say that that's like wrong. I'm in no position to say what's wrong or right, but I don't see minimalism as specifically its own unique goal to pursue. I see it as an outgrowth of a deeper spiritual and healing practice. And I use ideas that I come up with about minimalism to guide my actions as I do this healing so that I can kind of craft like a subsistence life for myself that does not use up too much excess. And of course, I should be careful as I say that because a subsistence life means different things to different people. Like, I still own a laptop. You know, I don't need a laptop in terms of like meeting my food needs. But if I'm going to connect with the larger world in this day and age, you kind of need some way of engaging with computers. I do have a smartphone, although I'm very, very picky about what apps go on it. So I don't use social media apps. So I'm not a Luddite by any means. I certainly embrace technology where technology is genuinely helpful for me, especially in the context of my educational endeavors. Mm-hmm. But I definitely, I live in a very Spartan way compared to a lot of people my age.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And you don't need to self-medicate with consumption as so many people unconsciously do.
Yeah. And that by itself creates a lot of its own degrees of freedom. Like, I live pretty comfortably on about $1,500 a month. Mm-hmm. You know, notwithstanding paying student loans, which I don't have to pay right now because of the government programs. Mm-hmm. But yeah, when I need a lot less stuff, I also need a lot less money, which gives me opportunities to be a lot more conscientious about how I earn money. Whereas I feel like I meet people who, you know, in their way of seeing themselves in the world, they feel like they need a much higher income. And to sustain that, they're willing to do things that I might not be willing to do.
Right, right. Today, you're listening to Islands of Sanity with me, your host, Carolyn Baker, and my guest, Eric Garza. If you're finding this podcast valuable, please consider leaving a donation as a way of expressing your gratitude for the information and wisdom that Islands of Sanity brings you regularly, especially in this time of the COVID pandemic crisis. Well, Eric, as you know, and as we talked about in your interview of me for your podcast, I'm framing our current global predicament in terms of a planetary rite of passage or an initiation of the human species by the Earth. And I know that you too resonate with the theme of initiation in our current predicament. And I'd like you to talk about initiatory experiences that are happening now or at other times at the individual and collective levels.
I would love to do that. I see initiatory experiences or rite of passages. People use those, both of those terms, and probably a few others, as basically ways of navigating endings, like ritualized or ceremonial ways of navigating endings. And, you know, in traditional societies, they would use initiatory experiences to move people from one life stage to another. You know, an adolescent would be given a rite of passage, and that ordeal, and it was definitely an ordeal that was potentially dangerous oftentimes, that ordeal would force them to let go of certain, shall we say, immature ways of thinking, perhaps, and in order to get through that ordeal. And so what that did is it left openings so that when they emerged from that ordeal, they could, mentors in the community could fill those openings with more adult, mature behavior patterns that would allow them to plug into society and, you know, take up more mature roles and help that society stay strong. I don't think that that transition from adolescence into adulthood is the only place for initiatory experiences. I think that that can be very useful and probably was very useful in other, you know, transitions between other life stages as well. That's typically how initiatory experiences are looked at. It's an interesting model, I think, or an interesting metaphor, rather, to apply to what we're going through today, but it's also not a perfect metaphor. I think what's happening today in society is that we've entered a phase where society is changing very fast. And there are certainly certain institutions, social institutions, political institutions, ways of relating that have to end. And there are certainly new ways that need to be adopted once, you know, with the empty space from those other endings. But I don't know that it's really about transitioning from an immature society to a mature one. I think what's happening is that, you know, if we think of the broader trajectory that complex societies go through, you have this long stage where that society becomes more complex. And it tends to grow in terms of its population, in terms of its infrastructure, in terms of all the different layers of bureaucracy in its governmental systems. And eventually you reach its zenith, where, you know, for all kinds of different reasons, it can't grow anymore in at least some of those different metrics. And then it starts the process of simplification. Oftentimes because it exhausts resource bases or, you know, other things. And it's not so much about transitioning from an immature society to a mature one, in as much as it is transitioning from a society that could depend on growth to one that has to organize itself around the endeavor of simplification. Because there are two ways society can simplify. It can simplify in unplanned an unmanaged way where everything is haphazard and people are fighting. You know, this is kind of the pattern that we might think of as collapse. It appears as collapse to the people that are living in that time. Or we can make that transition into a society that understands what's happening, and rather than resisting that, it honors that, it shows up for that need to simplify. And it engages its populace and says, okay, we have to do this. We all know we have to do this. Now, how can we do this in such a way that is as compassionate as possible and as inclusive as possible? And you mentioned earlier on about how certain groups of people in the United States are being disproportionately affected by the coronavirus pandemic that we are seeing, you know, African Americans. You know, I have some acquaintances who live on the Navajo Reservation in New Mexico. And they are suffering a lot as a result of this. And it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, that those those disproportionate impacts are a symptom that we are right now entering into this collapse phase in a very haphazard way, where everyone is like, I'm going to get my piece of the pie and hold on to it for as long as I can. I'm not buying into this understanding that it's time for us all to simplify, just not going there. And you know, ultimately, it doesn't have to be that way. We could, if we wanted to, if we had the political will, if we had the social will, if we had the social insight, we could approach this in a very different way that still leads to the same place where society simplifies year after year. Probably the economy shrinks. We might have to, decommission and maybe demolish certain infrastructural aspects of infrastructure, but it doesn't have to have the horribly negative impact on people's lives that it is probably, at least in the near-term future, going to have. So I think of the initiatory experience at a societal level in this way. It's not so much transitioning from immature to mature as much as it is transitioning from a complexifying society and all that goes along with that to a simplifying society and all that could go with that if we were to approach that endeavor with compassion and insight.
And don't you think that there is a maturing process for people who go through the ordeal and begin to wake up to what it's calling them to? Not that they're necessarily going to create a mature society, but they themselves become wizened and probably more compassionate and probably more creative in the process. Not that they're going to create another wonderful society that really meets the needs of folks and doesn't disturb the earth, but that maybe in their own lives, in their own little worlds, in their own communities, they can create those kinds of structures.
Yeah. And maybe we can call that maturity. I guess I still hesitate to think of it as maturity, in as much as I think of it as just a different value system. Mm-hmm. And as I'm speaking this, I'm warming up to your characterization of maturity here, actually. So I'm kind of talking myself out of what I just said. But I mean, I see a lot of value in defining maturity in that way. Like, we have a choice when we speak with one another about how we define things, like what does it mean to be mature? And so maybe part of navigating this ordeal well is to be very deliberate about how we start defining maturity and say that an integral part of being mature in this time that we're faced with very much is recognizing this broader pattern of society and very much is, making this commitment to compassion and inclusiveness in our little worlds that we live in, mine in Vermont and yours in Colorado, and just holding, steadfastly holding on to that more inclusive understanding of maturity and trying to hesitate to use this word, but I'm gonna trying to sell that amongst our peers. Yeah. As like, this is okay, folks, this is like what we've got to do. Let's show up for this and figure out what it's going to take for us to step into this kind of maturity.
There are many folks, and I consider you one of them, there are many folks who are waking up to what is involved here, what we're being asked to do, many, many more who aren't. And it seems to me that one of the things nature is saying, through this pandemic is, you guys need a course correction. I'm going to send you to your room until you get it. And that's going to be painful. It's almost like nature has intervened to shut things down and compel us to learn some of these lessons and what it really means to be a human being. what it means to be a developed, wizened, evolved human being. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And I am always very cautious when I hear about those kinds of narratives, because I know that there are, I certainly know personally a lot of people whose situation is so precarious that they can't afford to use this opportunity to do any kind of the self-development healing right. stuff that I'm able to do.
Yes.
And so I you know, maybe Earth is conscious, maybe it is. I'm not in a position to say that it's not, but I hesitate to just blanketly claim that and kind of carry forward that metaphor, just because, you know, in a lot of the reading that I've done over the last few months, I've seen a lot of people throwing that around in what I, you know, as someone who's mixed race, you know, part Native, part European, I see a lot of people throwing that narrative around, that metaphor around, in a way that I perceive to be very callous. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we say that this has been, you know, and even if we say that this has been, this pandemic has been put forward as a timeout for certain groups of people, it's affecting everybody.
Yes.
Yeah. And so, you know, the part of me that has been reading in, you know, a lot of environmentally themed material for years loves this metaphor. The other part of me that is becoming a lot more socially aware and connected with people who don't have the privilege that I do is deeply skeptical of it. Mm-hmm. And so and you can probably tell this just by the way that I'm kind of waffling through my response.
Sure.
I struggle mightily to navigate that paradox.
Yeah.
And so I'm just very cautious about lifting up that particular metaphor. Maybe there are ways that we can develop that metaphor further so that it doesn't, like, put everybody in the same basket. Mm-hmm. Because certainly everyone's experience is not the same right now. But I've not seen anyone articulate that metaphor in that particular, in that way yet, in a way that satisfies me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the most important thing is to have awe in the face of what's happening, to really stand back and go, wow, you know, what is this calling me to do? Who is this calling me to be? And the first thing, I think, is to respond to the call of compassion and to do what we can to assist people who are in those less served, disadvantaged, oppressed groups. You know, how can we serve them? Because their experience isn't our experience. And so, you know, what did I come here to do? You know, one of the things that I'm so, you know, and I loved your podcast yesterday. The thing that I'm so passionate about is that young people now who were going to become freshmen in college or, you know, or high school students who were going to go to that first year of college or whatever they were going to do, is to take that time off and become part of this national service, which there are some folks in Congress trying to create a national service program, but right now we've got AmeriCorps. And my gosh, wouldn't it be amazing if those young people could be out there helping with the testing, helping with the contract tracing, helping with, you know, getting food supplies to places, you know, certainly raising organic food, but being put and supplying, supporting healthcare workers, you know. There's so many things that we can be doing to support those who are really, really getting oppressed by and hammered by this crisis.
Yeah. Yeah. And you referenced this, and so people have a little bit more information about it. I recently released a video to YouTube where I basically invited college students and those who might attend college starting this coming fall to take the next year off. mainly, you know, strictly from a standpoint of their experience. Like universities and colleges are not going to be able to offer the kinds of experiences college students expect for the money that they're going to be spending. And yeah, all kinds of political stuff is going to be happening on campuses, and students probably aren't going to want to be caught in the middle of that. But yeah, like the next question is, okay, if a student decides to take a year off or decides to defer enrollment and take a gap year, what do they do? And it would be, and you know, just going back to our earlier conversation about initiatory experiences, it would be a wonderful opportunity to give a large number of young people a meaningful initiatory experience that I certainly didn't have. I mean, I had what in hindsight was an initiatory experience, but it was a suicide attempt, and I wouldn't recommend that to anybody.
Right.
And so this, I think, is a wonderful opportunity to give young people some kind of an initiatory experience that can really tie them to their communities, wherever that happens to be. And I so very much hope that we don't squander this. And maybe they'll come up with something at the federal level. Mm-hmm. And if they don't, hopefully, you know, states or even, you know, counties or cities or just communities, you know, we don't even necessarily have to have a government involved.
Right.
Even communities can figure some way to put, you know, the idle hands to work. And in that context, not even necessarily young people who might otherwise go to college, but there's plenty of people in the United States right now who don't have gainful employment. And if you can't, you know, if they can't find a living wage job that they can get into, then at the very least, we should try to create opportunities for them to contribute to their communities in a way that can at least tie them into the community at a deeper level. You know, I work at the outskirts of a lot of nature connection type communities, and a story was relayed to me by a colleague of mine that I thought was just really powerful. And if you've got a moment, I'd love to share that.
Absolutely, go for it.
So this comes from Africa, from the San Bushmen in Africa. And a colleague of mine, you know, leads kind of like ecotourism things with them, you know, tracking expeditions and that sort of thing. And a story that was told to him by one of the San elders, Johansi people is what I should say. The San Bushmen is kind of their colonized name. But a story that was told to him by one of the Johansi elders was that every time a child is born in their community, they see that child as having been born with four threads. One of those threads connects that child to itself. One of the threads connects them to other members, living members of their community, human community. The third thread connects them to their ancestors, their human ancestors, and the fourth thread connects them to their more than human world. Mm. And the job of adults in that community is that as that child matures, they also need to nurture all of those threads so that they grow into these stout, thick ropes. And if they can accomplish that task, when that child is ready to become an adult, those ropes allow them to plug into society in a way that allows them to just become to help their society stay strong and resilient, you know, in the face of all the stuff that they have to deal with. If they fail at that job and some of those threads don't grow into thick ropes, what's going to happen is that when the time comes for that child to become an adult, they're not going to be able to plug into society as adults and take on those more mature roles. And as a result of that, if more and more young people fail to make that transition and plug in, that society is going to grow weak and frail. And I feel like we live in the United States, you know, you and I both do, and a lot of what we're seeing playing out politically and socially is the result of a lot of people having a lot of frayed threads and not realizing that.
Yes.
And not having the tools at their disposal to strengthen their own threads and help them plug in, or strengthen other people's threads and help them plug in. And so we live in this just gigantic frayed society that seems to be in this perpetual state of identity crisis. And there's no like silver bullet easy solution for this, but a good starting place is realizing what the problem is and realizing that we really need to focus on this, on, you know, all these different threads of connection, along with going back earlier on to our start of the podcast, learning how to heal our trauma, which is, I think those two things are really intimately linked.
Absolutely. Beautiful, amazing, powerful story. And Eric Garza, thank you for being with us today. And please let us know how we can contact you.
Sure. I think the easiest way is just through my website. It's under construction right now, so it's not as fancy looking as it hopefully will be in some number of weeks. But my website is ericgarza.info, ericgarza.info. All my social media links are there. You can contact me. And yeah, I think that's probably the best way for people to get in touch. And all the contact features still work fine, even though it's not as graphically pleasing as it will be soon.
It will be soon. Thank you for joining us, everyone, today. We'll be back with you again soon for another episode. And in the meantime, do create islands of sanity in the many seas of chaos that we are sailing.
This is Dream Vision 7 Radio Network, uniting mankind with universal love. Our shows are created from the heart, bringing each listener to a place of divine enlightenment. Breathe, relax, and enjoy. Let life flow.